Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times, where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm delighted to be joined this week by Rory K. Smith, Matt Dickinson and Stuart Robson. Let's kick things off with a blue day in Liverpool. Everton and Chelsea. Dico Jose Mourinho comes out after the game and talked about how they dominated, and it was just one of those things that they came away with 0 points and the worst start of any manager in the Roman Abramovich era, I might add. Is he right?
Yeah, sack that fool. What does Mourinho know? No, I mean, well, they certainly had the chances to win, didn't they? Eto had a few. Schürrle stuck one over the crossbar, didn't he? I mean, their first half, they looked like they should get ahead and should win. I mean, I think clearly there's going to be a bit of adjustment time, and we're going to, you know, the nature of our profession, the nature of football is that we all want to rush to judgment, and but there's an awful lot of settling down to be done by, you know, an awful lot of teams, especially the top teams in the league, and not least Chelsea, where, you know, the manager, I mean, as Mourinho, I mean, you know, Mourinho is speaking the truth while giving himself some excuses when he keeps talking about, you know, the players he has been given. I mean, clearly Eto was one of his choices, but, you know, he's sort of talking about, this is what I must do with this squad, this is what I must do with the hand I've been dealt. And he's just trying to buy himself a bit of time, because he clearly knows that it's not necessarily going to be, well, it's certainly not going to be comparable to the 2004-2005 version that he took over and could dominate from the start.
Do you guys share Dico's view? Just for context, looking at the games until now, they demolished a horrible whole side. They really, I thought, huffed and puffed to get past Villa. Mm-hmm. It was the stinker at Old Trafford where both teams seemed to park the bus. And now this, where I thought actually they didn't play that badly. I thought they maybe played as well as they've done in any Premier League game this season.
I thought in the first half it was a really good game of football. It was a good tactical game. It was played at high tempo. And I thought Chelsea were outstanding in the first half. Their creativity up to a certain point. And everybody, including me, during the summer said, there's one position which I think they're lacking. And that's the centre forward. Torres is no longer good enough. And Eto looked a shadow of his former self.
Shadow? And if it's a bit harsh, isn't it?
And if you haven't got a centre, I thought so. I thought he didn't play well enough. And I think if you haven't got a centre forward,
this is his first game in ages.
But you're bringing him in. He's left Torres out the side. If he comes into the side, he's got to play well. And that was. And you asked me why Chelsea didn't win the game. The reason they didn't win the game is because the centre forward they had on the field wasn't quite good enough. Because everywhere else on the field, I thought they were better than Everton.
Will you join Stuart in the demolition of the legend of Samu Eto'o?
No, I think he's right. I think he's not fit enough yet, but I think that can be excused by the fact, as you say, Gabriele, in your eternal wisdom, that he has not played very much football recently. But I agree with Stuart that Mourinho will have known that, he'll have seen that in training, so if he's not ready, then maybe he should have played one of the strikers who is fit. Torres is fit. He's obviously not the player he was, but he is fit, so why not just play him?
Because Eto'o is a better player, makes the correct runs,
yeah,
and has more experience and more charisma. And,
yes,
and
I agree.
If he never plays, he'll never get match fit.
I agree with all of that. You're right about the match fitness. That's kind of a dilemma that he's in.
1-0.
But Eto'o is a better player than Torres, yes, when he's fit, but he's not fit. Understandably so, but he's not fit.
Some might say he's a better player than Torres every day of the week. Dicko, the other choice, we saw Juan Mata again. Obviously, there was so much speculation, and you know, and I need to go back to this for some of the people who think that you know the media just make things up to start controversy and whatever. Apart from the fact that they have a million attacking midfielders, it was a journalist we all know who is extremely close to Jose Mourinho who first floated the possibility that Mata doesn't fit with a counter-attacking, high-energy style, hard work style that Mourinho wanted to come up with. You're asking me who? Duncan Castles, that's who. Who wrote this you know, way back in the summer. Now, I want to get your take on it. Do you get the impression, Dicko, that Chelsea, for reasons that perhaps we don't know or understand, are stuck with Mata? Or that they had a change of heart, and now that he's there, he figures might as well play him and do the whole rotational thing?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think there's more than one place. I know someone else who speaks to Mourinho sort of privately who had exactly the same vibe going back a few months that he didn't see Mata necessarily as, you know, his ideal player for the type of fast break football that he plays and certainly for the sort of, you know, risk averse tracking back sort of play that he requires from his attacking players. So you know it was clearly based on decent sourcing and decent evidence. I do think it goes a bit deeper than that. I think he clearly has some reservations, but he's in the squad. He's got the talent. I just think we won't see him clearly as much and as integral to Chelsea's style as we did. Oscar and Hazard will clearly be more involved, and we wait to see just how quickly Willian can fit into the system and the league.
And Chelsea aren't always going to have to play. Aren't always going to be playing a counter-attacking game when they're at home against sides that defend very deeply. Mata can come into the side. It probably wasn't the ideal game for him against Everton, but there will be times.
That was curious, wasn't it?
At Stamford Bridge, this game. Yeah, again, I mean, at Stamford Bridge, when teams defend deeply, Mata's the one that can unlock the door because there won't be space in behind for the counter-attacking play.
All right, so let me throw this out there to you, perhaps Roy or Dicko. Dicko said that he wasn't under pressure from the club to, you know, make a decision on this, and the club went and let him have, you know, the millions of attacking midfielders he has. Should he have been under pressure? Do they know something that we don't know about financial fair play and assets? And in terms of squad management, when you've got so many people in a World Cup year, you know, and just to remind us, De Bruyne, Schürrle, Hazard, Mata, Oscar, Willian, all six of those people, of those six, I'm assuming Belgium qualify. I think the only ones who are nailed on to go are Hazard and Oscar. And only Hazard is really a guaranteed starter for a World Cup team. That's something that can come back to haunt you, leaving aside the whole financial side of things, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Those players will all want to play. And if it gets to January and they're not playing regularly, then they will have difficult decisions to make. I think with Mata particularly, does it mean people like De Bruyne and... And even
so do you think that you revolve your whole career around a World Cup?
No, but I think that if Mata's not playing, he will, and it gets to January, I think he will start to think, hang on, there's half a chance I might need to go here. I think that is a possibility. I'm not saying, obviously, you don't. He wouldn't necessarily think, right, I'm not playing, I've definitely got to go. But it will form part of his thinking. I'm absolutely certain of that.
I mean, the Rooney thing could have obviously been the game changer. I mean, if they got Rooney and had to pay, obviously, you know, 40 million quid for Rooney, then that could have changed the Mata situation, as Rory says, because I think then there would have been some pressure applied to bring money in. Now that Chelsea, as we know, are a perfectly run break-even club with
it's quite interesting though, Matt, wouldn't you say, that they were after Rooney because if he doesn't like Mata because he's not a counter-attacking, or not a quick counter-attacking player, and won't burst forward, well, Wayne Rooney's not that sort of player now anyway.
Well, that's the fact. It would have been fascinating, wouldn't it, because we have to work on the basis that he would have played Rooney as a nine, and obviously we know he did that, you know, tremendously for Manchester United for one season in I think it was in 09-10, wasn't it, when he excelled as a number nine, but it's certainly not the position that we've sort of come to see him in. And as you say, as he gets older and, shall we say, probably rather less mobile, even less you see him in that position as a in the Chelsea system. So that there was a curiosity about that, which I could never quite resolve, to be honest.
Of course, there's some conspiracy theorists out there who suggest that this whole Rooney thing was always a smokescreen, and that by talking so openly about it, all he was doing was messing with David Moyes' head and perhaps doing Paul Stretford a favor. But hey, we'll never know. Or maybe we will one day. But I want to talk Everton because, you know, we all Roberto Martinez fans, aren't we here? We all praised the squad they put together. Gareth Barry looked good. I thought it was a bit absurd how people like praised this, this tackle of the century, blah, 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 on Samuel Eto'o there when Stuart, I mean, help me, you played the game. When that happens, it's instinct, and you just kind of rush across, and you hope that you get a foot to it, right? I mean,
it's good determination. It was good awareness from him, and all that, and he reacted well.
But it's not like it's a defensive masterpiece.
No, I mean, it's the obvious thing to do. You race across, you try and get a block in, and that's exactly what he did.
But he did play well. Can we talk a little bit about the way this is looking? I mean, Barry, Osman, Barkley, McCarthy to come in. Is this what you'd pictured from Martinez?
No, it's not what I pictured from Martinez because I met him in the summer at the Confederations Cup and he talked all about playing with three at the back, how he was going to play with three at the back, and he obviously hasn't played with three at the back. He was talking about Darren Gibson being one of the centre-halves. Then he bought Alcaraz and obviously he hasn't been fit. So I think when...
He was tricking you, Stuart.
Yeah, well, I think when Alcaraz gets fit, he definitely wants to play with a back three. That's really the way he thinks that football should be played these days, and so he will eventually go to that.
What would you do then? You have Distan, Jadielka, and maybe Darren Gibson, which would be interesting as the back three. You could still play three in midfield, but you
still have Baines and Coleman.
Coleman as your fullbacks. Then you have Barry, Barkley, McCarthy.
Osman.
As your three.
Then what? 3-6-1. There you go.
What, Osman just behind?
It depends how you do it. And Gabba know this about Italy, a lot of them play with two up front. When you play with three at the back, you play with five across midfield, with one sort of slightly further forward. And then they play with two up front who try and link up. I'm not sure that's the way Martinez would play. He didn't really play that way at Wigan. He played with an overloaded midfield.
To be fair,
up front.
When he talked to you, he didn't know he was getting Lukaku.
That might
change things. Maybe, might make him more prone to wingers, perhaps, or whatnot.
They don't massively have the huge resources on the wing, do they, Everton? I really like Leon Osman. He's a good technical footballer, like Pienaar, but he's not an out-and-out winner. There's De La Feu. It's not that. You do wonder whether they might go 3-6-1 or something. That'd be quite. It's just Roberto Martinez being an innovative genius again.
Naismith, on the goal. I mean, you could say it was against the run of play or whatever. Mm. Is that a defensive blunder there, Stuart?
They didn't react quickly enough at times. I saw John Terry go towards Nipper. He tried to recover back in. They didn't defend the ball to the far post. I don't think there was too much they could have done about it. Everton had players in the right positions. Ivanovic didn't defend it well enough at the far post. And as I say, John Terry had just gone across the field and then tried to get back in. But there was other things that happened that made them make those sort of runs. So I don't think there was too much wrong with the defending. I think Jose Mourinho would be disappointed with it. But you couldn't say there's the mistake or there's another big mistake. It was they reacted to other things that happened and it just so happened that the ball went exactly where they didn't want it to go.
Moving on to the Britannia Stadium at Stoke and Manchester City. It's funny because going into this game, I was asked to sort of pick out, where could we see an upset or at least one of the favorites not getting all the points. And given the way City have played of late and given that, you had a highly motivated Mark Hughes in there against them, I thought this could be it. And I felt vindicated. But I was a bit sad because, like Rory, I've been bigging up Pellegrini the whole time. And I thought this was absolutely horrible for Manchester City. I don't think there's any excuse. I know he's rotating and whatever else and Aguero and he came back from the international break, all this jazz. But, you didn't have 11 turds out there. Am I being harsh on how bad... Are expectations for City too high?
No, I'm disappointed with what Pellegrini's done because I saw them a lot during pre-season and I thought their free-flowing football was excellent. They were trying to press the ball high up the field. They were playing at a really good tempo. They were getting their fullbacks high up the field. There was great rotation in the front areas. Didn't see that on Saturday. But the one criticism I did have of their form in pre-season was that they tried to play this really high offside line without, in my view, knowing exactly what they were trying to do with it. And it looks as though they could be broken down. Well, that wasn't the case on Saturday. So all the things I've seen over pre-season, the first few games, didn't come to fruition. They didn't play at high enough tempo. They didn't look as though they were going to score goals, but they didn't look that poor defensively. So it was a strange performance from Man City.
Dicko, are you happy? I mean, obviously he rotated a lot. Fernandinho, Dzeko, obviously Aguero. And obviously Kompany's not there. My colleague Tony Cascarino made a big deal about it in his Tony Awards. But does Kompany's absence explain why they were so horrid?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it looks like another manager groping around a little just to see what parts fit. But I mean, you look at the lineup, it seemed oddly flat from the start. I mean, I'd prefer to see Yaya Toure further forward for one thing. When Nasri has a game as horrible as that, you're sort of pretty much down to a three-man midfield. It looked an uninspiring way the team was set up from the start. And I'd say I think. Yeah, we've seen so much change at these big clubs in the summer. Yeah, we see a game like that, and I was at the Newcastle game where they were blitzed them in the first game this season. You saw one City, and you saw them on Saturday against Stoke, and half the team's changed, and the style are completely changed. And I think there are a few clubs like this that we're sort of they're groping around to find any kind of rhythm. And when the manager's making as much rotation as that, it's not going to help. I do wonder whether he'd actually help himself by settling down the team a little more. But then, equally, when you've spent a fortune on Jovetic and Negredo, how easy is that to do?
I think the other thing is that when new managers come in and results, kind of I think Cardiff sort of rattled them a bit, understandably. And then I saw them against Hull. They weren't quite lucky to win. They probably deserved to win, but they were certainly lucky not to concede. I think what the managers tend to do is try and just get the one basic, which is we will not concede, right? So as Stuart says, the lines got deeper. They're basically saying, right, we will keep a clean sheet and we will build on that. And that, I would guess, is a process that'll take a month, 6 weeks for Pellegrini then to add a little bit of rhythm and tempo further forward. But his main priority at the moment will be to avoid defeat, I'd have thought.
What message does it send though when you continue playing Javi Garcia at the heart of your back four, when you've signed De Micheli, so I'm assuming he wasn't on the bench, so I'm assuming he's unfit or just not very
well,
good.
Well, no, it may well, but do you not think that he'd have looked at Stoke and thought, I mean, I know Stoke have changed and they're playing attractive football.
But he should play a big, strong guy like Javi Garcia?
No, but I wonder whether he maybe thought that's not the place for Martin De Micheli to begin his career in England.
What about Julian Lescott and Dedric Boyata? I mean, and
Lescott, I agree with you, yeah.
I mean, I don't think Boyata's terrible either.
Okay.
But I don't know. It just looked to me like it just seemed like very sort of curious choices that he made. And I mean, like, you and I love the guy, and that's why it pains me so much. But how do you see when we see stuff like this, in your opinion, Rory, is it a case of him not knowing certain things about the Premier League, or is it just a case of him perhaps making poor choices on the day, or things just happen?
Well, I think Ditto's right, to be honest. I think he's probably looking around his squad and thinking which bits worked where, and he's still got questions. He's only had 3 months. That's not kind of a blind.
But they got all the transfer dealings done early.
Yeah, but you know what?
They had all their ducks in a row.
They did all that as they should have done. But the one thing I'd say about City is the signing of Jovetic. Right, so you've got Sergio Aguero is your first choice striker in Manchester City.
Has to be.
He is one of the three or four best players in the Premier League.
Well, first choice depends if you play one up. I mean, you could
depends
play
how you
Aguero
play
from
yeah.
a wide position as well.
But you have to play Aguero.
Yeah.
Dzeko seems to have started, and you've signed Negredo, which suggests that he wants kind of a target man alongside Aguero, or with Aguero and Silva sort of buzzing around him.
Or Navas,
yeah. Navas then is the natural kind of natural width. So you've got Silva, Aguero, Navas, and then one of the front men. Where does Jovetic fit in? Why did they sign Jovetic?
I might argue that Jovetic is actually quite versatile. He can play as a first striker, a second striker. Maybe he just sees Jovetic as the backup to three or four different positions.
That's a lot of money to spend on backup.
It is, and also, I mean, it's interesting. Dzeko is one of those players that, and it's been said for quite a while, that he needs a run. I mean, he needs to feel loved. He needs to get into a flow. He's not a player who can sort of, come in and out. I mean, that was the sort of, I guess, the great thing about United with their when they had the four strikers, was that the players who came off the bench, accepted their roles and knew the roles and almost became skilled in changing a game off the bench. But Dzeko is not necessarily someone who's got that capacity, physically or psychologically. And that's another problem for Pellegrini. He's just trying to work out, not just who he picks, but what effect it's going to have on those players he doesn't pick.
But I go back to an earlier point you made, Matt, about Yaya Toure, where he plays in the team. When he plays as one of the deeper midfield players, he slows the game down. He slows the tempo of Manchester City's build-up play. When he plays further forward, he starts running with the ball. He starts driving forward. And he's a far better player. And that's why I could never understand why Mancini didn't stick with three at the back last season. Because when he played three at the back, it meant that Yaya Toure could play behind the front two. And it looked a much better formation when they were doing that.
I can tell you why. Because he had a bunch of players who just couldn't seem to understand the thing, and you need a bunch of people in the media and a bunch of ex-pros like yourself, although not you specifically, saying like, why is he playing a back three? It's so negative, it's so thick, it's so stupid, blah, blah, blah.
It was brilliant when they played. I saw them all through pre-season playing with a back three, and how the players couldn't cope with it. He did it all pre-season, and why didn't he do it once that season started?
I want to get a word in about Stoke, because obviously there was so much negativity, I thought, around Mark Hughes because of everything that went wrong with QPR, and because it always going to change the way they play. Which, all right, I mean, Mark Hughes isn't Marcelo Bielsa. You know, he coached Blackburn. We know he can do a more direct, more physical game. He can also play a different game as well, which I think he tried to do when he was at City and certainly at Fulham and QPR. Obviously, everything went wrong. Should we be surprised? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Mark Hughes was considered one of the real up-and-comers, right?
Do you know what? There's this weird desire in the media and amongst fans to kind of cast managers either long ball managers or tiki-taka, tippy-tappy sort of passing managers. Most managers, most football falls in between the two. Hughes is not... I mean, Hughes' Blackburn were not a long ball side per se. They were a brutal side. They could mix it, I believe, is the terminology we have to use on such occasions, which meant that they kicked people. They were tough tackling. They weren't an unattractive side. They were just a normal football team. They went long and sometimes they played a bit shorter. Hughes is he's not Bielsa. He's not some great visionary. He's a decent manager.
And I think Stoke suits him because you're absolutely right. They will mix it. They will. They're the underdogs in most games, and they're going to get their foot in. They're going to be well organized. And that's what he does well. Where he struggled, Mark Hughes, is to add that little bit of creativity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think at Stoke they're going to get that creativity. So it's going to be getting the ball forward, then from the top third of the field, then they're going to have to play around the box, get crosses in, and they will look quite a good side. But it's not going to be that flair.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I'm just saying. But that's the right way to play if you're a side that are just below halfway or that's where you want to be.
What I like about it is he's also taken certain players. Like, I've always thought Mark Wilson was actually a very good passer of the ball. The reason he doesn't play the higher standard is because he's tall and slow, but under the previous manager said, oh yeah, you go at left back and just hit the ball or pass the ball long, Pulis might say. Now he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is he's a midfielder. He's got decent vision.
But he's also got two good feet as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, he can hit it with both feet, which again, like, you know, when he was stuck at fullback, I thought was absolutely horrible. Plus, he'd get skinned as well. Midfield, it doesn't matter if you get skinned, because if you beat Wilson, then you run into the monsters that are Shawcross and Huth. And I mean, to me, I think that's something that Hughes has certainly done well. Now, just because my cab driver on Saturday once had Stephen Ireland in the back of his cab, I have to ask, percentage chance Stephen Ireland regains his mojo, Rory?
36.
Stuart?
25.
Dicko?
I'm going lower. Nothing about his past record suggests that penny drops.
And then I go back a few years and I remember when people were talking how Stephen Ireland was one of the best attacking midfielders in the Premier League.
He was, but I'm not sure he has the commitment to recover that.
And I think he's lost a bit of athleticism as well. At that time at Man City, he was running past people with the ball, he was running past people off the ball. I can't see him doing that now.
He was Kevin Nolan with wheels back then.
He certainly was.
All right, enough of this. Time now to talk some refereeing. One specific referee in particular, Mark Halsey. He's subject of a debate this week. Now, a bit of background. Mark Halsey was...
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As a Premier League referee for 14 years. Dicko, I know you're writing your column about this for Tuesday's paper, so feel free to jump in and correct me if I say anything that's inaccurate, because I'm sure you've researched this much more than I have. But Mark Halsey has a book out now, and some of those extracts were published in a Sunday newspaper. And I think there were two things that really made headlines that I personally found troubling. One, perhaps a little more minor, but when you had the whole John Obi Mikel, Mark Clattenburg incident, where you'll recall John Obi Mikel supposedly thought that Mark Clattenburg had racially abused him, everybody involved accepts that this was not the case now. According to Halsey says my information is that Mikel burst into Clattenburg's dressing room, threatened to break his legs, which I believe is a criminal offense in this country, and also tried to throw a punch at him. Now, assuming he's not making all this up, he must have got the information from somebody who was in the room, or possibly somebody at the FA or whichever body then investigated investigated the incident. That makes some people, I think, a bit uncomfortable that this stuff should come out now in this way. The other thing is he revealed that Sir Alex Ferguson is his mate, and he rings him up on a fairly regular basis, and he shares texts with him and so on. And then there was one line which actually made me physically angry, where he says, it's something along the lines of course, I would lose the respect of the players and the fans if I showed any favoritism because he's my friend. It's something I'm paraphrasing here. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what are you? You think we're all demented? Do you think we're all stupid? You wouldn't just lose the respect. You would be cheating the game. You'd be cheating your profession. You'd be cheating your employers. I was just flabbergasted when I saw that. So, Dicko, I want to start with you. Can you give us a foreshadowing of what your thoughts might be?
I mean, like you, there's troubled on a number of levels, and the Mikel revelations, the fact that he only got a 3-game ban. His mitigation was, as you say, that he thought he was racially abused. But even with that mitigation, when you see the full sort of extent of that. The threats. You rewind that story and wonder whether that was dealt with properly. But like you, that's just an aside, really. It's the whole chumminess that bothers me, and this does follow in a long line of referees' books, which, I mean, instinctively we all think we should defend referees. They have a blinking hard job. And they get abused enough without the rest of us joining in. And then their books come along and you just want to, well, hurl the books at them, to be honest. I mean, Jeff Winters was a laughably shambolic, egotistical account of how the game revolved around him. Graham Poll told a story about him basically begging Zidane for his shirt during a Champions League match once. And now Halsey comes along and talks about how he's text buddies with Fergie. And it's this sort of neediness that I'm sort of, well, certainly be writing about tomorrow, this sort of chumminess, which I'm sure is not true of every official, but the most scary thing about the Halsey revelation so far, I'd say there's the Fergie chumminess, but I mean, he became almost bezzy mates with Jose Mourinho. There'll be some stuff I'll be writing about tomorrow about the extent of that relationship, which involved Mourinho sort of paying for Halsey's family, admittedly after an illness in that family, but even so, to go to a 5-star hotel in Portugal. And he sort of says, oh, well, you know, I wouldn't have gone if Jose had still been at Stamford Bridge, but, you know, I thought, well, what's wrong with that? It raises, at the very least, it just raises the troubling question of sort of how matey some of these relationships get. And as you say, the sort of barefaced, the brass neck of a referee saying, but hey, guys, don't worry. When I ran out on the pitch, I still knew that I had to do a fair job. I think a lot of fans just won't buy that.
I want to ask Stuart a question, because I think this is a big issue. This kind of, what the referees seem to have decided is that they need to police by consent, that they need the players to kind of, that they're part of kind of a performance and the players need to be kind of on side with them. But first I want to say that I've been refereed by Mark Halsey, and he didn't give me a penalty in a media game at Goodison Park. That was definitely a penalty. He is a shambles of a referee and an outrage to his profession purely based on that one incident. But the question I want to ask Stuart is, when you were playing, what did you call the referee?
Mark?
You never called him by their name. I wouldn't even know who the referee was.
Would it be sort of ref or...
Ref, yeah.
Just nothing?
There was nothing. You didn't know the referee. Yeah. You know, I mean, the only one I knew that was one that sent me off was David Axel. It was the only time I was sent off. So every time I saw his name on the programme, but I didn't know who the ref was before the game. So you read the programme and you had no communication with them. They just dealt with it. But I think this is a worrying trend in football, not just with officials, but with pundits, with journalists. Everybody wants to be a mate of the managers. Everybody wants to be a mate of the players. And we go back to my little bit, what I said about Roberto Martinez. I was quite unhappy that I had to work with him on the Confederations Cup, because I then thought, having spent 3 weeks with him, how do I report on Everton's games when they're not playing particularly well, and I don't like the style of football he's playing, and I think he's making mistakes? And that's the same if referees start to get pally with managers. It's the same when journalists, I know they have to get stories, but in the end up, they give biased reports because they're friendly with...
I think that is an issue, and I think you're right with pundits as well, and that chumminess is something that maybe has kind of contributed to Match of the Day being seen as kind of a dinosaur's sort of playground, because people are afraid to criticise their friends. I think with referees, though, it's fundamental. More dangerous. What was interesting in the Everton-Chelsea game, when Gareth Barry gave away a free kick quite harshly, I think, I can't remember who he brought down, and he said to Howard Webb, and you could see him mouthing, he said, Howard, come on, I got the ball. He shouldn't be calling him Howard.
All right, I want to bring this back to Halsey, because frankly, I appreciate what you're saying. I personally think that referees, ultimately, I think we need to judge them by their work on the pitch. What I'm concerned about is the appearance of impropriety, is the flouting of the rules. And I'm concerned about something else. Do we know what circumstances he was calling Sir Alex Ferguson under? I mean,
well,
I have...
One of them, he goes into specifics.
No, I know, but Dickel, I want to put this to you, right? I have Sir Alex Ferguson's number, right? So I could ring him up, and we're not mates, but I know the guy. He knows me. I've spoken to him before. But if I start ringing him, right, and let's assume I was a powerful person within the game, like, say,
Which
a Premier League referee. Yes, even more powerful. As powerful as Mark Halsey was at the time. I'm assuming even Sir Alex would start taking my phone calls and be like, oh, yeah, okay, Mark, all right, sure. And then I start texting him funny stories and funny pictures I find on the internet. And he'd be compelled to respond, because otherwise, you know, what, you're too big to talk to Mark Halsey? I would love to know what's going through. In fact, I have an idea of what's going through Sir Alex's mind right now, that he's being dragged into this. Because the reality here is that I mean, in my country, in Italy, Juventus were sent to Serie B for something like this. You know, the PGMO code says, and they repeated it today, very explicitly, Dicko, you cannot have contact with players or managers outside of your job, outside of the pitch.
No, absolutely. And that's what, I mean, in case people haven't read it, or one specific incident where he admits to, he rang Fergie to say, after the Clattenburg was accused, to say, look, you know Mark wouldn't do such a thing. Can you come out in support of him in the media? And Fergie, oddly enough, thinks, well, you know, here's killing about 87 birds with one stone. He basically can come out, he can defend a referee, which obviously gets him chummy with that referee. And
to be fair, Dicko, we only have Halsey's version of this. We don't have Sir Alex.
Yeah, but he gets the slag off Chelsea at the same time. But all I'm saying is that, yeah, but Halsey has willingly admitted that he rang Fergie to ask him a favour. To throw his weight behind. Now, it's just, I mean, it's the naivety almost of the admission that is that. I mean, obviously, Halsey's moved on, but I mean, to say, it's the same with Pohl's book. And I don't want to brand the whole profession based on the mad rantings of a few of them, but it's, you know, we all go to games, we all see that sort of, say, certain neediness and the star buttering is the polite way of putting it, and it is troubling, and I say I'm almost more worried about the lack of self awareness in some of these sort of revelations and memoirs, that he wouldn't even think that the rest of the world will go, oh my God, what were you doing all this time, and what more lies underneath?
That was kind of my point about what players call referees. I've spoken to referees before, and they say they try to build these relationships with players. And that I can understand the theory behind it, but I think the danger is, and the fact that, do you know what, even the fact that they're publishing books shows this. The referees are convinced of their role. They're convinced that their role in this whole thing is far more interesting than it ought to be. As Stuart says, they should be anonymous. They shouldn't have relationships with people in the game.
If certain referees think they referee better when they've got that kind of relationship, I really don't have an issue with it, as long as they apply the rules. But
you don't have an issue. You don't think, okay, I mean, to go on the poll example, he begs for Zidane for a shirt. Zidane. And then Zidane basically says, Zidane goes to take his shirt off at the end of the game to give it to him, at which point he says, oh, no, don't do it on the pitch, because he knows, you know, Pohl clearly knows it's going to look like it smells to high heaven. Zidane comes to his room afterwards to give him his shirt. Now, if you're, you know, if you're the opposition, you see that, if you're anyone who sees that, that doesn't trouble you?
You're absolutely right, Matt. And I'll use an example. I was head coach at Wimbledon, and we played at Blackburn. And I can't remember who the referee was. But Graham Souness was the manager of Blackburn at the time.
Sweet.
And before the game, during the game, the way the referee was talking to Graham Souness was as if he was in awe of him. You know, in the when we were given the hand in the teams in before the game.
To be fair, he is Graham Souness.
And what a great player he was, and what, you know, good manager he was. But the
great pundit too.
But the referee was embarrassing how nice he was to him. And when Graham Souness was giving him stick during the game, he said, "No, don't worry, Graham. You know, I understand what you're saying." It was just wrong.
If they have these relationships with people, how can they? You are opening yourself up to a huge array of potential sort of complications. That's the issue.
Well, that's precisely the appearance of impropriety. And the other thing also is I have a huge problem with you going out and revealing what happened in a private confined space. Somebody in that room leaked to Halsey what happened, or I'm assuming there's witness statements, somebody at the FA did. Now, if I'm the FA, I'm extremely concerned about that, or indeed the PGMO.
I think if you read his book, you'll be in no doubt as to who he is speaking on behalf of, put it that way.
Well, Clattenburg.
I would be dumbstruck if that was not the right answer.
It could be Clattenburg, it could be one of his, whatever the case, right? If the PGMO comes to that conclusion, you drag Mark Clattenburg and his three assistants in there into your room. You don't have control over Di Matteo and Newton and Mikel. I think it's safe to assume that it wasn't Chadobi Mikel who said, like, yeah, I thought he called me an effing monkey, and so I went and threatened, you know, I'm assuming Mikel's not ringing up Halsey. And you put those people and say, do not lie to me. Did you go and talk about this with Mark Halsey? right? And then see if they look, they look you in the eye and they tell you the truth. Because I think this is a situation where trust has been broken. And I think it's going to become increasingly hard to have faith in the FA, in the disciplinary procedures, and even in the referees. Because we saw, and we'll get to this in quick hits, or coming up in a minute, we saw a referee make a colossal mistake this weekend, right? I want to think he made a colossal mistake because he had some kind of brain fart, or he read the situation wrong, or whatever else. I do not want to, it makes every referee's job more difficult when we've got this kind of thing going on. And I'm just shocked how irresponsible Halsey could be.
Well, I just think, I mean, above all, it just makes you think that they Mike Riley, and the questions about whether Mike Riley is tough enough for that job, full stop. But, I mean, he clearly needs to be sitting down with these guys and just absolutely reading the riot act about what type of relationships they have. And as I say, and ultimately, you know, as you say, in some ways we should judge them on their work. But I'm afraid in the position they're in, the appearance of fairness is no less important, and that's absolutely crucial.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, I think Mike Riley, I've met the guy, he's a nice man. If he need, you know, I agree with you, he needs to read the riot act, he needs to get tough on these people. If he doesn't do it, bring back Hackett for one last go round, because I'll tell you what, Hackett would not, he had other faults perhaps, but he would not have put up with this.
But I'd like to make a plea to our thousands and millions of listeners. If you're thinking about buying a book by a referee, there is an entire canon of literature out there that would improve your mind and add great wisdom to your life. Do not buy a book by a referee. It's ridiculous.
And then you can move. It's, I think it's a gateway drug. Apparently you move on to Traffic Warden memoirs after that.
It's just awful. Go and buy something by Umberto Eco or something. Go and buy a good book.
All right, Manchester United defeat Crystal Palace 2-0, but Ashley Young, oh great, here comes Rory, another question on referees. Ashley Young makes headlines for the wrong reasons. He's accused of diving twice, he gets booked for one, he wins a penalty for the other. Davey Moy says he'll speak to him about it. Rory, you're known for sticking up for players who dive, especially foreign ones. What do you make of Moy's statement? Isn't he kind of hanging Young out to dry? And also, wouldn't a referee behind the goal, like Michel Platini suggests, have rumbled Young?
Yes, he would have done, I think. That is absolutely correct. I don't see why they've not introduced that in the Premier League. Moyes' statement is kind of hanging Young out to dry, but I can see why. I think Moyes does genuinely dislike diving, and he should discourage Ashley Young not from diving, he should discourage him from diving badly. That is the problem. If you are good at diving, dive. If you know how to win a foul, do it. If you're terrible at it, which Ashley Young is, don't do it. You make yourself look like a moron.
Yes, any parents out there, please disregard, and then don't allow Rory K. Smith near your children or you'll teach them how to cheat. All right, Stadium Alight, Bakary Sagna holds back, Altidore bearing down on goal. Big strong Josie shrugs him off just as Martin Atkinson blows his whistle. Altidore then goes on to score, but Atkinson calls it back and doesn't play advantage, nor does he send off Sagna for denying a goal-scoring opportunity. Come to think of it, I guess it was Atkinson himself who denied Altidore's goal-scoring opportunity, so maybe he should send himself off. Dicko, please make sense of this.
Well, the only sense you made is the referee's made a horrible ricket, hasn't he? I mean, it was a clear case where he could have given a bit of a few seconds advantage. He waits to see if Altidore sticks it in or not, and when he doesn't, when Altidore does and he's already blown his whistle, he realises, I think the TV caught him looking sheepish, I guess is the best way to put it. He realised he'd dropped one pretty badly.
Stuart, here's a chance for you to say something nice about the Arsenal. How about that? Would you rather wax lyrical about Mesut Ozil or Rambo, Aaron Ramsey? One guy was dumped by Madrid. The other one was unloved by the media and the Gooners not that long ago. And yet, between them, they ripped Sunderland apart.
Well, I was doing the game and I made Aaron Ramsey the man of the match, not just for his two goals, but for his all-round performance, I think.
He's come on in leaps and bounds.
He has come on, and they've got a good formation. And they're going to destroy a lot of teams in midfield because they played a diamond in midfield. They left the left-hand side open, although Jack Wilshere was probably started out there. They're a great positional rotation, and they almost played with wing-backs, with Jenkinson going down the right-hand side whenever Walcott went in field, and Gibbs likewise down the left-hand side. The only problem I can see is if they don't defend corners, particularly Arsenal look a much better side this year, and it was held together by Flamini. You talked about Ozil, you talked about Ramsey, we've talked about Wilshere. You have to have a player that can defend as well, and Flamini did that job really well against Sunderland.
So tactically, Wenger nailed this one.
He certainly did, but will they defend well against the better teams?
Newcastle get a huge 3 points at Aston Villa as Hatem Ben Arfa steals the show. Rory, you had a bunch of sarcastic tweets on this subject on Saturday. I expect you to have something to say about this.
Yeah, my sarcastic tweets were about the fact that Newcastle started the day 12th, and they've spent most of the season in crisis, apparently, and Villa, who are the kind of coming force, the young bucks of the Premier League, started the day 13th. Newcastle deserved to win. Ben Arfa was fantastic. He is cutting inside from the right on his left foot. He terrifies defenders. But I think the person who deserves a huge amount of credit, although I didn't give him man of the match in the paper today, is Mapu Yanga Mbiwa, who gave an absolute masterclass of how to deal with Christian Benteke.
Yanga Mbiwa is a monster. I hope he gets regular playing time going forward. It was quite a week for Gareth McAuley. He scores a goal against Luxembourg for Northern Ireland, but they somehow contrive to lose. And then he gets a last-ditch equaliser for West Brom at Fulham. And I believe he also scored against Portugal as well. Dicko, we often overlook the little guys, especially people like McAuley, who is now 33 years old, but I think 7 or 8 years ago was playing amateur football and had a real job, or a day job anyway. Do you want to wax lyrical for me?
Are you expecting me to get excited about Gareth McAuley's far post header against... I mean, I know it's good for West Brom, and they've got a point, which they desperately need a point, but... He scored a goal in a losing embarrassment for Northern Ireland.
You know what? I expected something loving, or maybe even sighed-like, something scientific about the chances of somebody being in a different possession, in a different profession, and then a few years later living the dream of being in the Premier League and playing internationally for his country and stuff like that.
Maybe I'm being cruel. Maybe this was a week when the McAuley family celebrated like never before. But I'm hoping they have better ones still.
He was putting up drywall 6 or 7 years ago. Now he scores in 3 consecutive games, and he's an old central defender. I think that's pretty cool. Anyway, Stuart, there were plenty of Eriksen skeptics out there before he signed. He was too slow. He was too soft. He was too unathletic. He was too ugly. But after those 2 assists for Spurs against Norwich, you're on board with Danish Dynamite, yes?
Yes, I think he's a good player. I've seen him play poorly on several occasions over the last 2 or 3 years when I went to see him and thinking this is going to be the player. But he played well on Saturday. He linked up the play.
Playing for Ajax in the Eredivisie, where they win 8-0 against a bunch of mannequins.
I was talking about when I saw him play for Denmark. But I saw on Saturday he did a lot of good things. He linked up the play. He made forward runs at the right time. He picked out his passes. And he looked an exceptional player. And he linked everything together. So I think it's a good signing for Tottenham. And he will be one of the stars of the Premier League.
Who's going to get more assists, him or Ozil? That's what we're all talking about, isn't it? That's the big assist this season, the new goals.
Yeah, you know what? I'm all for stats and analytics, but that is one statistic, which I'm just not on board.
I've got a new one. You can do pre-assists, because Ozil gave a pre-assist for Arsenal's third as well. So maybe you could have assists and pre-assists to prove that one of those two players is the best player in the world.
If you want to indulge Rory K. Smith's emerging insanity, you can find him on Twitter.
Christian Eriksen's no Seam de Jong, by the way. Gab, one for you. Big news out of Madrid this weekend, but which is more important, Gareth Bale scoring on his debut or Cristiano Ronaldo's new contract?
Well, given that your story on this occupies page 2 of the game today, I'm assuming we're in agreement that it's Cristiano's new contract. I think it's absolutely huge. It's an absurd amount of money. Work it out. It comes out to about £580,000 a week, to put it in terms that people in this country might understand. People seem to struggle with the idea of net wages and gross wages. I think it's hugely important. 16 months from now, he would have been in a position to negotiate with any other team. This way, Real Madrid have him locked up. There was a suggestion that, coming from Real Madrid, obviously, that they were being offered more money from 2 other clubs, and that those 2 clubs were Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester United. I do not believe the United bit for 1 minute. PSG, anything's possible. I'd imagine if there was another club, it was probably Monaco. The good news is that if he throws a strop and decides he wants to leave for more money, and there's no indication that he will, Real Madrid at least will get something like fair market value for him, and that wasn't the case before Sunday.
All right, that's all we've got time for now, but you can catch Ahead of the Game, top analysis, and all the goals if you subscribe to The Times. Go do it now. For those who don't know, Ahead of the Game is basically like a 23-minute show hosted by the excellent and very handsome Matt Lorenzo, where we basically go over things from the weekend. It's a pretty neat show, and we set up the following week as well. Thank you to my guests, Mr. Stuart Robson, Mr. Matt Dickinson, who did a duathlon this weekend and played 90 minutes of football. And also drank a lot of beer, is that right?
Yeah, not in that order either.
Oh, there you go then. And of course, Rory K. Smith, who I sense is regressing a little bit. But hey, there's time to work on that. You can email us at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk, as so many of you do every single week. We love to hear from you. You can also hit us up on Twitter. Dicko's on there. Rory's on there. I'm on there. Stuart's more of a Luddite, so you can write to him. He likes receiving postcards. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.